This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
As the world becomes more fragile, the Transition Town movement spread from Totnes, England, to more than 50 countries all over the world. Rob Hopkins co-founded that movement. He is, I think, the most public face of it. So why did Rob move on to create an imaginary life? And why did his new book create such a doubtful, almost angry reaction at first in me before I even read it? Rob Hopkins used his flow of connections to explore experiments changing our thinking and our lives. His book really surprised me. He traveled, he did interviews, he did a lot of interviews. And these other voices, they appear for us, voices which you and I would not ordinarily encounter. Rob's new book, From What Is to What If, Unleashing the Power of Imagination to Create the Future We Want. It is almost like an annotated directory of experiments in social change. That's what I found in it. Rob Hopkins, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you so much. It's been a while and lovely to be back.
Yeah. So seriously, before I could read your new book, From What Is to What If, I had to write a rant down about 3 pages long against people who suggest a happy ending to the mess we're in. I think it's going to be much darker than that. Have you had to overcome that kind of pushback to the idea that what we need now is more imagination?
No, not yet. It's the first. That's really interesting feedback, actually. I mean, I guess what I do find is I have been doing a lot of talks. I've been kind of taking this book on the road, I guess, for the last few months. And I find that it really resonates with people, and there's a lot in there that people find refreshing and a really different way of looking at things. But always in the questions, there's always the, but surely it's too late, Rob, question, which I think opens up a really fascinating space for conversation. You know, I don't claim to have a crystal ball. I guess the point of the book, where the book came from, was I kept reading people like, people I really admire, some of whom may well have been on the show, you know, people like Bill McKibben and Naomi Klein, George Monbiot, people like this, and David Wallace Wells, who kept saying climate change is a failure of the imagination. And this phrase really started to stick with me. But I found myself thinking, what do they mean? What do you mean it's a failure of the imagination? Why are you saying that? And then they would just move on and talk about something else. So I was left there thinking, what does that mean? Could it be the case that climate change is a failure of the imagination? And then I read some research that was done in 2010 by a researcher called Kyung-hee Kim in the US, who looked at this thing called the Torrance Test for Creative Thinking, which had been done with big data sets of people back to the 1960s. They call it the gold standard creativity test. It's done with 20, 30,000 people a year going back that far. Her conclusion when she looked at all this data was that imagination and IQ rose together till the mid-90s, and then IQ kept rising and imagination went into what she called a steady and persistent decline. And what spurred me to start researching this book was, that's really important, because when it was published, when her research was on the front page of Newsweek, it led to a lot of soul-searching in the U.S. about what does this mean for economic growth? What does this mean for Hollywood? And I never heard anyone in the climate change and social justice world say, what does this mean for us? And I was looking around and I was seeing amazing new emerging movements like Extinction Rebellion, this kind of deep adaptation sort of idea. And I was kind of concerned that actually we had these movements that were trying to radically transform everything to give us sort of any chance of making it through the next sort of century. But often fundamentally at their heart, they had this narrative that said it's too late. And so it felt to me like there was a really important role to look at, well, but what if that's not the case? What if actually we were Extinction Rebellion? What if the Extinction Rebellion actions that are happening this weekend in London and the global school strikes and Greta Thunberg actually led to a cascade of tipping points of change and unlocked a whole kind of rethinking of everything, that the next 10 years at the moment we can barely imagine was a time of extraordinary social transformation? Because if we can't imagine that to be the case, it never has any chance of being the case. So the book was really an exploration of saying, what is the state of health of our collective imagination in 2019? How have we got into this position where we have created this kind of perfect storm of factors that reduce our capacity to be imaginative and to see things as if they could be otherwise? And what would it look like if we were to actually kind of reconfigure our movements and our narratives and the way that the societies work in such a way that we set out to really increase our collective imaginative capacity?
Well, Rob, my imagination is working, but it can be frightening. My mind, for example, might show me transition towns filled with impoverished refugees in a world way too hot. Maybe people are afraid to imagine because the future looks so dark, according to the reports we get from scientists, even on this show.
For sure, but actually most of those scientists that I speak to, there is a degree of climate change to which we are already committed. But actually many of the worst-case scenarios assume that we don't do anything. And the IPCC's report about 1.5 degrees was very clear in saying, but actually, if we were to see rapid, urgent, and far-reaching changes to all aspects of society, we could avoid the worst of it. So my sense is I'm not prepared yet to let go of the possibility that rapid, urgent, and far-reaching changes to all aspects of society are possible. And actually, most of the great social change movements of the last century had at their heart a narrative and a belief that what they dreamt of, they could actually create. Martin Luther King didn't stand up in Washington and say, I have a dream. But actually, it might be a bit expensive and it might inconvenience some motorists. And it's probably too late anyway, and I don't know what I was thinking. You know, I completely get that within the climate change movement, we have a spectrum of people, from the people who say it's all too late, we've lost, we are now on an inevitable slide into catastrophe, and the people who are the kind of drawdown, sort of, well, we can pull together all of these different things, and if we can ramp up and we can make them happen. I completely get that there is a case to say it's too late. I think there's also a case to say that we are capable of doing extraordinary things. And my sense at the moment is that we are starting to see the tectonic plates under our feet around climate change kind of start to shift. And so it feels to me really important to give that a voice, I suppose.
Another startling idea in your book, maybe the future doesn't have to be about digging a hole and filling it full of tin food. It almost sounds heretical, but some of the big change could be fun. Tell us about Antanas Marcos in Bogota, Colombia.
Yeah, so the woman who I mentioned before, Kyung-hee Kim, who wrote this paper called The Creativity Crisis in 2010, at the end of the paper, she tried to explain why it was that in the mid-1990s we started to see this decline in imagination. She said it's due to the decline of play in our culture, that actually most kids now start compiling their CV from the age of 4 and are kind of ferried from structured activity to structured activity and don't get to do the kind of hours of daydreamy kind of play that was more of a feature when you and I were younger. She attributes it to the rise of screens in our lives, and she attributes it to the rise of testing in schools. And so in the book, each of those things has a chapter of really going into more depth and saying, what's going on? You know, why have we seen this catastrophic collapse in that kind of unstructured free play? And if we lose unstructured play out of a culture, what are we doing? When we have a generation of kids who don't do that kind of play anymore, what kind of adults do we create? So in that chapter, I look at where can we find examples of policymakers and political figures who value play and who bring play into what they do. And so I tell the story of a guy called Antanas Marcos, who was the mayor of Bogota in Colombia. And his political career started when he was the dean of the local university, which was infiltrated with lots of rebels, kind of very extreme left-wing rebels. And so he couldn't, any kind of assembly at the university, he couldn't be heard because everyone was shouting and screaming at him. So one day he dropped his trousers and mooned the entire hall, as a result of which he quite justifiably lost his job. But he used that as a platform to run to become the mayor of Bogota. And he ran in his campaign dressed as a superhero called Super Citizen. And he was elected extraordinarily. And he was a great believer that, that play should be central to politics. And he did many things that were just fantastic. But my favorite one was that at the time, the traffic police in the city were notoriously corrupt. And they had one of the highest death rates on the streets of the city. So when he was elected, he sacked the entire traffic police department. And instead, he hired a team of 400 mime artists who came in and stood at all of the intersections. And they had red cards and yellow cards like soccer referees. So when a car was badly behaved, he would show it a red card. He said, the one thing Colombians fear more than the traffic police is public humiliation. And I loved that idea that, you know, you fill the streets with mime artists. And he said to all the police who lost their jobs, you can have your job back if you retrain to be a mime artist. So the book, it argues that actually at the moment, every government that we elect comes in with an innovation strategy. We're going to create a national innovation plan. We're all about innovation. I argue that actually at this point in the climate emergency, innovation is kind of irrelevant. Because innovation is something that you do when your fundamental model works. So if you think of pizza, for example, you can innovate with pizza because the fundamental model of pizza is great. Everybody loves pizza. You don't need to reimagine pizza because pizza is great. Growth-based neoliberal economics are not like pizza. They are pushing us over the cliff. And in that case, what we need to do is reimagine. And we need to cultivate imagination in our culture. So as part of that, why not have mime artists on traffic intersections? You know, a lot of the stories that are in the book are those kind of things that are, you know, like in the city of Bologna in Italy, the municipality there in that city created a civic imagination office, which sits between the people and the municipality, and it works like a transition group. They run open space and visioning exercises. The powerful bit of it is that the ideas that are then generated through that process, the municipality then sits down with the people and says, okay, let's create a pact around this. We'll offer a building or some land or some tools or some money or some professional help if you provide some people and some time and whatever, and then they create a pact. And actually what's so powerful about that is then you have communities being invited to be imaginative, being trusted to be imaginative, to ask the big, bold questions of now that governments are just too generally too terrified or unimaginative to ask. And then the municipality sees its role as to get alongside them and say, how can we help? What do you need? And in the last 5 years, they've created 500 pacts, which go from small gardens on streets up to taking an empty building owned by the district and turning it into a center to train young people to become classical musicians. So there's something there for me about that feels really exciting. If we try to tackle something as vast as climate change with the same thinking that got us into it, it's not going to happen. If we think that we're going to find a way through it that doesn't call on our ability to tell great stories, to play with each other, to do activism which brings a different kind of a future to life in a really immersive way, then I think we're really in trouble.
I used to live in Vancouver, Canada, and I just want to squeeze this in because I think there's something important in it, and that is that it very seldom snowed there, but one time it dumped 2 feet, the city was helpless, and the kids all poured out, and they played in the street, and my kids met some neighboring kids that they had never seen before and played with them. And I would like you to tell our listeners about the playing out movement in the UK.
There were several bits of the research for this book that were almost as depressing as reading climate science, actually, which is saying something. One of which was about the decline of play in our culture and the loss of spaces in which children can play, the loss of that culture. Another one was all about school and education and the devaluing of imagination in our education system in 2019, which is terrifying, frankly. So playing out is I wanted to see if I could find a place in the world where play was making a comeback and where people were intentionally creating deliberate spaces for play to happen again. And I came across a movement called Playing Out, which started in the city of Bristol and has now spread to many other places in the UK. And it's about supporting people to close their streets so that kids can play. And it previously used to be really complicated. You had to apply to the local government for a permission for every single time. In Bristol, the city council streamlined the process. So you just had a form, you went through it, you ticked out all the different dates you would do it, you sent them in. As long as you had two parents in high-vis jackets at the end of the road, then it was fine. And I went down to Bristol one evening to go and visit a street where this was happening. And the street was full of kids flying around on skateboards and scooters and skipping and drawing in chalk on the pavement. And I talked to parents who were there who talked about how, firstly, they saw it got their kids outside away from screens. It got them to feel more confident about working with each other. They saw a real kind of leap in terms of the imaginative output of the work that they were doing and the drawings that they were doing. One of the dads said that about the adults in the street, he said, we found that we actually quite liked each other. So it was building that kind of social cohesion and social kind of capital as well. One of the mothers said to me, all you have to do is get the cars out of the way, and then this is what happens. You know, so sometimes you might, there's this idea that maybe, you know, imagination sort of dies or something. You know, actually, imagination is like a muscle. And you have to work it. And if you don't work it, it kind of goes flaccid. But at the same time, you have to create the right conditions. So what she said to me was, when you get the cars out of the way, this is what happens. You take the cars out of space, all the kids come out and all start playing and start inventing games. It's one of the things that runs through the book is that question of what does imagination need? It needs for us to have space. It needs for us to feel safe. It needs us to feel connected to other people, because imagination really is a kind of a joint activity as much as it's a kind of an individual activity. And in many ways, we're driving all those things out of our culture. The space that we have, we fill with working too much and screens, and people are just kind of running on empty. So for me, this has really been a book about, I guess, in the same way that Rachel Carson's Silent Spring was saying, look, we have this amazing diverse ecology. We have this enormous threat to that. It feels to me like I hope in one of the things I see this book as being is a kind of silent spring for the imagination. Unless you value it when it's there and create the best conditions for it, it fades and it fades and it fades. And because as it fades kind of gradually, we don't necessarily notice that process until we're really in trouble. And, you know, we're now in a time when, for me, these enormous changes that we have to make are only going to happen if we can mobilize everybody around us. We can create these kind of what-if spaces, invite people to step in and think differently. And that is fundamentally work of the imagination.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. And next up, we get more bright ideas to exchange these troubled times for something better. Our guide is Rob Hopkins, author of From What Is to What If. And, you know, you mentioned the imagination being like a muscle, and I read in your book that, in fact, in the brain, there is a section of the brain that is really key to the imagination, almost like an organ, if you will. Would you tell us about that?
Yeah, this was one of the many things that I really had no idea about until I started researching this book. So in the center of your brain, kind of low down in the center of your brain, there's a part of the brain called the hippocampus, which is named after its shape, which is a bit like a seahorse. And it is the part of the brain where your memory and your imagination, because memory and imagination are almost the same thing, and they both fire from this part in the brain. So the networks that form in our brain when we're being imaginative all have the hippocampus at the heart of it. The thing that was most fascinating to me was that part of the brain, out of all the parts of your brain, is the part that is most uniquely vulnerable to cortisol. So when we are anxious or stressed or traumatized, the hippocampus can shrink by up to 20%. People with PTSD, they have a hippocampus that can be up to 20% smaller. And when that happens, when the hippocampus shrinks, what they observe in people is they lose the ability to see the future in hopeful and positive ways, and they get stuck in the past or they get stuck in the present. And when I came across all of this and I spoke to some leading neuroscientists who study this, you know, I thought that really sounds like where we're at collectively, that our hippocampi are shrinking, are contracted. We are creating the conditions where we're living in a time where psychologists call this the age of anxiety. We have an epidemic of loneliness. We are seeing record levels of anxiety and stress among teenagers in particular. We have governments here in the UK who are creating austerity, this sort of politically engineered, I would say, assault on the imagination, where you are cutting all the funding for creative things and the arts, and you are ramping up the cortisol in a society. So for me, it was a really interesting thing to say, well, how could you rebuild the hippocampus? Where can we find places where that is happening? Because so many people in society are operating in a way where their hippocampus is severely stressed. So I went to visit this amazing place in Dundee called Art Angel that works with adults with mental health problems and anxiety and stress and trauma, and works with them using art and imagination. They say, when you walk through the door here, you're not a client or a patient, you're an artist who is preparing work for an exhibition. And every year they put on a big exhibition in the biggest gallery in Dundee. And I spoke to various people who were there who said, before I came here, I couldn't imagine the future. I couldn't see a future. It just wasn't there. And now it's coming into focus, and I want to do this, and I want to do that. And I spoke to the people who ran it, and they said, fundamental to what we do here is we create a space of safety, and we create a space of hope. And that really kind of resonated with what we've been doing in the transition movement in the last 12, 13 years, which is to create spaces of safety and hope, to create what-if spaces, which there are so few of now in our culture, where people come together with other people to say, okay, what if we reimagined the food supply in this town? What if we created our own energy company? What if we did da-da-da-da? And it really sort of emphasized for me how important those places are. And I like to talk about now how actually what we need to do is to create a campus for the hippocampus. You know, we need to see the places where we live as being like a campus for the hippocampus. How do we create the best conditions for the hippocampi of the people that we live with to really flourish?
And we have to battle upstream, I suppose, what you call the disimagination machine coming through the mainstream media. And you also talk about technological tyranny. What do you mean, and what can we do about it?
Well, I think we have these, we most of us carry around in our pockets these extraordinarily addictive devices to which we are evolutionarily under-equipped to be able to master them, and rather than them mastering us. There's a whole chapter in the book about attention, because the relationship between imagination and attention is really, really fascinating to me. How can we be imaginative when our attention spans are completely shot to bits because of the phones we have, because behind those devices are people who value our attention much, much more than we do, and who want our attention to be focused on their platform rather than on actually where we feel we need to be going. So there is a chapter about the connection between imagination and attention, and what would it look like if we really set out to very deliberately rebuild our attention spans and to have a healthier kind of a relationship with those technologies. One of the things that I forgot to mention as well was, you know, when you were saying at the beginning about how you felt that the book was, I don't know, I could, kind of paraphrasing, but, you know, you felt that it was sort of unjustifiably hopeful, I suppose, about the future and about possibilities. I guess, and I said about how when I give talks and people say, well, surely it's too late. There's an exercise that one of the things that I was, when I was researching the book, that I went to do was an improv course, to learn the skills around kind of theatrical improvisation. It was such fun. I really recommend it to anyone who's listening. And one of the exercises that we did on that course, which I now do with groups, I did it last week in Belgium in a hall with 1,500 people and got them all doing this exercise, which is the difference between yes but and yes and. So you get into a pair with somebody else and you take it in turns to start a conversation. And the role of one person is to try and be enthusiastic, and the role of the other person is just to shut down that enthusiasm. So you might say, hey, Rob, we could go to Paris. And I would say, yes, but I don't really like Paris, and I don't like French food, and I'm a bit busy next week. And, you know, it's that experience that is sort of pouring cold water onto someone else's enthusiasm. And it's something that many of us who out in our communities and at work who are trying to kind of motivate people to do something about climate change, we encounter it all the time. Yes, but it's too expensive, and yes, but it'll never happen, and yes, but, and you know, so much of our time as activists is met with this wall of yes, but. So then we do an exercise where you do yes and, where the idea is that you take what the person said And you build on that, and you do this backwards and forwards. So you might say, let's go to Paris, Rob. And I could say, yes, and we could go up the Eiffel Tower. And then you say, yes, and when we get there, we could write love letters and make them into paper airplanes and throw them off. And so we go backwards and forwards like that. And it's such a powerful exercise, because I always find when I do talks, there's always yes, but comes back in the questions, yes, but. And it's completely justifiable. But it's also really important that we build in the yes and. That we make that space in those conversations to say, yeah, but you know what? It is possible we could do this. There are extraordinary things that go on around the world. There's so much that is moving and happening. And for me, when we did that yes and activity on that course, it was a really kind of revelatory thing of, oh, yes, actually, maybe our activism could feel like that. And maybe that's actually what it'll feel like when we pass the kind of tipping points of kind of energy, energizing, building around this kind of activism. And I start to see it in some different places where transition is really taking off, or where you've got city governments who are really behind this kind of stuff. They're building this kind of yes and culture, and it's always such a wonderful thing to see and experience.
Rob Hopkins, are you considering setting up some sort of imagination network to keep us feeding the best ideas out to everyone, or what is your next step?
That's a really good question, and I wish I knew the answer to that. I've spent the last 2 years immersed in writing this book. As you said, I've done about 100 interviews with some amazing people and visited loads of projects. And at this point, I'm deeply, deeply curious to put this book out into the world and to see what happens. And hopefully it won't mean that everybody writes kind of a 3-page rant before they then are able to kind of pick it up and read it. I'm hoping that actually it will, and certainly the kind of early feedback I've had from people has been really good. And I would like to do something from it which is about giving people who are working in climate change the ability to, like, it feels to me like there's lots and lots of people who are doing brilliant work about supporting communities and activists through the loss and the grief that many people experience when they come to a real understanding about climate change and that kind of thing. But I think at the same time, we also really need that sort of, how do we bring to life for people the future that we could still create? If we could mobilize, if we were to see the Greta Thunberg effect and the climate strikes and Extinction Rebellion and all of the movements that I'm sure have appeared on your show for years now, if we were to get to a tipping point, which feels to me, I feel building around the world now, where the argument that the only moral thing to do now is concerted, ambitious, imaginative reimagining of everything in the context of climate change. If we're able to do that, part of that will come from our ability to tell the stories, to help people to imagine it, to bring it to life through art, through theatre, through pop-up events in high streets, through all kinds of different things. And I'd like to do stuff which gives communities those tools, those resources, those kind of yes and, the ability to play, the ability to invite people to... Because a lot of people, I think, are really... What manifests as denial and kind of angry, kind of skeptical stuff is often people being unable to imagine what else there would be. You're clinging to what is because you can't move to what if, and you can't think of other ways of doing it. And for me, there is a really powerful inviting of artists and creative people and writers and actors and mime artists and a whole range of different people to make that happen. And one of the things that for me, which I hope people will get out of the book, you know, is that I read lots of books about climate change, and they often tend to interview the same people. They go to Michael Mann, they go to Bill McKibben, they go to Naomi Klein. I bet that most of your listeners who will pick up a copy of this book will have only maybe heard of one or two of the people that I interviewed in here. It went off in all kinds of different directions to neuroscientists and experts on play and all kinds of different places where for me it was continually fascinating. So I hope that it will also take readers on a journey outside of maybe our usual spheres of reference. And even if you don't agree with all of it, I hope there's enough stuff in here where you'll go, I haven't quite looked at it like that before.
Actually, that was my experience. I really enjoyed it. So, Rob, what is the best website or Twitter handle to find out more about your new book and your ongoing work?
So people can find me on Twitter as Rob in Transition, and you can find me on Facebook and things. And so I still do things on transitionnetwork.org, but I also set up a blog called robhopkins.net, which is the blog that accompanies this book. And on there, the way that I like to work is that as I'm researching and as I'm doing the interviews, I post them all in real time. So many people have been with me on the journey of creating this book and all the interviews that I've done. So there's over 100 interviews and other things on there. There's podcasts of some of the most interesting places. So the street that we mentioned playing out, there is a podcast on there where I interviewed parents on the street. So hopefully there's a really interesting resource that, you know, you can read the book and go, that guy sounded interesting. And then you can go and find the whole interview and listen to the podcast and go into it in a lot more depth. So the book is really a kind of just a beginning, hopefully, of people's journey into all of this stuff.
RobHopkins.net. I'm going to go and explore there. From the UK, we have been speaking with the co-founder of the Transition Towns Movement, Rob Hopkins. His new book, From What Is to What If, Unleashing the Power of Imagination to Create the Future We Want. It's just out from Chelsea Green Publishing and in all the major booksellers. Rob, thank you for stimulating my imagination, all of our imagination, here on Radio EcoShock.
My absolute pleasure. So lovely to talk to you again.
I'm Alex Smith, and you can download this interview and all our past programs free of charge from the show website at ecoshock.org.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
As we face down a climate shift to a new hot state, some scientists suggest Earth's systems are not that sensitive. Maybe we won't get to 3 degrees C warming by the year 2100. Others wonder if the huge economic impact from climate-driven disasters could derail our suicidal urge to burn all the fossil fuels we can find. Or maybe there's just a better way out than that. Those are the kind of questions Patrick Brown takes on in some of the most prestigious scientific journals. Dr. Patrick T. Brown is assistant professor in the Department of Meteorology and Climate Science at San Jose State University in California. He studied under the well-known Carnegie scientist Ken Caldera and still often publishes papers with him. Brown runs the Weather, Climate, and Human Systems Lab at San Jose U. From California, Patrick Brown, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Well, the questions you wrestle with are big picture for sure. Let's see what we can cover. I just talked with the French senior scientist Olivier Boucher, and his team finds the worst case scenario could be 7 degrees C mean temperature increase over pre-industrial by the year 2100. I doubt that will happen. He doubts that will happen. But do you think we could survive 7 degrees C of warming in the unlikely event that it does?
I mean, 7 degrees C of warming over, you're talking about 80 years, is just a shock on the climate system that is, you know, really unprecedented. And it's very difficult to speculate what exactly would happen, you know, how society would shift and react to such a change. But it can't be good. I mean, given that the change between the last ice age and pre-industrial was about 4 or 5 degrees Celsius over thousands, you know, tens of thousands of years, if you're talking about like doubling that in a world with 10 billion people, and you're talking about over 100 years, you can just infer that that's going to be extremely difficult. But physical scientists like me speculating on exactly how society would adjust to that is exactly that. It's speculation. And so I don't want to say, you know, what exactly that would mean in terms of society itself.
In 2018, a team led by Peter M. Cox at the University of Exeter in the UK published a study saying climate sensitivity could be much lower. I think they said we probably would not get past 3 degrees C of heating. Could you explain their argument for us and then the reply you and Ken Caldera published in the journal Nature?
Sure. So we had a paper preceding theirs by just about a month, and then their paper came out, and then we had a comment on their paper, and they had a response to our paper. And these are all in using the same rough methodology, which is this emergent constraints methodology, it's called. And basically what that is we're using climate models to project temperature out into the future, and we don't know which ones are right. And so they give us this big spread of temperature projections out into the future. And so what the emergent constraint paradigm does is it says, okay, let's look at the models that are doing the best in terms of how they compare to recent observations, and then kind of weigh the projections in the future such that the best performing models get, you know, the most votes kind of in terms of what our expectation is for future warming. And so in our study, we used a number of variables having to do with the Earth's energy budget to constrain future warming. And we found that the most likely warming in the future was on the upper end of the range. And then Peter Cox and his team used basically the same type of methodology, but used a different observed variable and found that warming would be probably slightly lower than what the central estimate is. And they claimed that the upper end of the range was vastly reduced, so much less likely for very large values of warming. And so we were, you know, very curious about this result since it contradicted our own, and since it was using a similar methodology, we were kind of, you know, just set up to investigate it. And so we did a number of sensitivity tests on their results and found them basically not to be robust to different sensitivity tests. So I don't know, it's a little bit technical to get into for a program like this, but there's just a number of claims about how they're removing forcing from the historical record, that if you do it a more conventional way, then you essentially get a different result. And also one of their claims was that they had radically reduced the uncertainty in future warming. And that was really resting on the fact that they're starting with a number of climate models that already have a very reduced uncertainty compared to what we actually think the true uncertainty is. So if we think the true uncertainty is about 4.5 degrees Celsius warming for a doubling of CO2 to 1.5 degrees Celsius warming for a doubling of CO2, and that comes from a number of sources, but then you take a number of climate models that have a much smaller uncertainty and you do an analysis on them, that's going to naturally produce a smaller uncertainty in the future. And that doesn't really tell you anything. All that tells you is that the climate models themselves aren't representing the true range of uncertainty. It doesn't tell you that you've actually reduced the uncertainty through your analysis. And so that was one of the points that we were making in our comment. And so I think that overall the field is still debating this, and that you can use some observational parameters and get slightly above the model consensus and use different observational parameters and get below the model consensus. But this climate sensitivity uncertainty has been stubbornly persistent, that it's stayed there for a long time. And I don't think that it's going to be radically reduced anytime soon, honestly. I think we are basically going to have to move forward while not knowing exactly how much warming we're going to have in the future.
I agree. It's a scary thought, but I think that's what is really happening. Now, another problem is that big economic and climate reports just take our present human civilization and model it out into the future, and they don't seem to consider a big societal change or an economic crash or having to abandon parts of major cities like New York or Venice or Shanghai because of storm surges and rising seas. So a paper led by Don Woodward at the University of California calculated that damages from extreme climate change, in my opinion, could save humans from the worst levels of heating, or at least, she said, counterbalance warming from things like permafrost thaw and albedo changes. Patrick, could you take some time to explain what's going on with the Woodward-led argument?
Yes, as we continue to warm into the future, so we're putting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, and luckily for us, about 50% of the carbon dioxide we put into the atmosphere is absorbed by the ocean and the terrestrial biosphere. So the plants take up carbon and the ocean takes up carbon. And so that reduces the amount in the atmosphere. And so we, as far as warming is concerned, we only care about the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere. So it's good that the ocean and terrestrial biosphere are taking up carbon. It's not good for ocean acidification, I'll say that, but that's a separate issue. But as it gets warmer and warmer, we expect these carbon sinks, these fluxes out of the atmosphere from the terrestrial biosphere and from the ocean, to be less good at taking carbon out of the atmosphere. And so that's considered a positive carbon cycle feedback, that The more carbon we put into the atmosphere, the warmer it gets, and the less able the ocean and terrestrial biosphere are to pull carbon out of the atmosphere. And so that means that as you get warmer, you essentially get more and more warmer. And what this argument in the Woodward paper is showing is that we've also calculated that as it gets warmer, there will be damages to the economy. And since CO2 is essentially released when we produce energy to make goods and services, if there's damages to the economy, then we'll essentially release less CO2. And it's kind of this interesting calculation that they show. They're comparing the carbon cycle feedback from the terrestrial biosphere and from the ocean to this feedback on economic activity, and showing that, okay, as we get warmer and we start damaging our own economic activity, that will reduce CO2 emissions. Then you can think of the positive feedbacks from the terrestrial biosphere and ocean as increasing CO2 emissions to some degree. And those two things basically cancel out in their central calculation. So it's kind of this interesting result that's just saying that if neither one of these feedbacks was active, then we would have just as much warming in the future as if both of them were active.
And how do you feel about that argument?
Well, I don't think that it's very likely that society would just accept these large economic damages over the 21st century. So to mitigate climate change, if you were to impose a carbon tax, for example, that also slows economic growth from all the modeling that we do. But that's way more efficient in terms of if you wanted to maximize economic growth, it's way more efficient to impose a carbon tax and to reduce emissions that way than it is to just emit as much CO2 as you want and then feel the damages from climate change, right? Like through decreased crop yields and labor productivity and having to build seawalls and all this money spent on adaptation, all that stuff. And so I would hope and I would think that once those signals are being sent that we're actually damaging our own economy, that, you know, the foresight that would come along with that to actually implement policies would be implemented. And so we would reduce CO2 emissions and, yes, sacrifice some economic growth, but much less economic sacrifice than you would get from just experiencing all of the negative impacts from climate change. And so I think that's more likely. I mean, I feel like we're kind of seeing the tide turning now. I mean, it's been slow for several decades, but there's been momentum building for several decades up to the, you know, Paris Agreement. And then it just seems like the momentum is building and building for more and more policies to be implemented. I mean, here in California, for example, you know, we have laws on the books to be at zero net emissions, at least in electricity, you know, under short periods of time. So that seems like the direction that we're going. And again, I think that's the type of feedback. If you want to put humans into the dynamic system that you're studying, I think that's the type of feedback that would be more likely to be active than the damage to the economy feedback.
Well, I want to return a little later to the possibility of an intelligent human response, and that is our greatest hope. But meantime, the Wall Street crowd, it seems to me, hangs on to the broken window theory that climate damage may stimulate the economy rather than hurt it because, well, we have all those new buildings to make and new cities to replace and infrastructure to replace, and that means more jobs and business. What do you think of that argument?
Yeah, that doesn't make any sense to me. If we get stronger, more powerful hurricanes from climate change and they start destroying our cities, that is not an economic benefit to say, oh, look, there's all these jobs now to rebuild our cities. Like if you have new jobs to create something that you already had, you're taking away that labor resource from some other production that it would have been doing and just using it to recreate what you already had. And so you're not creating any new goods and services. You're just taking resources away from something that would have been creating new goods and services and using it to create something that you already had. And so that doesn't make any sense to me. But, it, you know, the same goes for some of the arguments of like green jobs, for example, that if you're increasing jobs for the same amount of, say, electricity produced, that is a cost on economic production. Now, I'm not saying that's not a cost that's worth it. It, I think, very well is a cost that's worth it. But that's why when we do these calculations of, you know, cost-benefit analysis of global warming policies, there is a cost there. It's not just always win-win-win-win. I would very much agree that the broken windows fallacy is a fallacy, and that creating, quote-unquote, jobs or things for people to do that is not new goods and services is not a economic benefit.
And trying to recover from climate change could also trigger another burst of carbon as we try to rebuild everything or change over to the new green economy. And so I just wonder, maybe we just have to do a lot less. And it brings me back to kind of Tim Garrett's argument from the University of Utah that the economy is really a heat engine. And the more you expand the economy, the more you expand the heat. And I think that's kind of what you've been saying all through this interview.
Yeah. I mean, it'll be interesting. Like, it does seem like there's a big, you know, technological component. In terms of the energy intensity of the economy and the carbon intensity of the economy, in the Western world, those have been decreasing, you know, not fast enough to meet various goals. But as we're getting richer, we are, in fact, becoming more efficient in a lot of things, right? So we're using less land per unit of calorie produced. Like, that's a good thing. We're using less materials in a lot of cases. And so there's definitely hope that these increases in efficiency can help us out. But yeah, there, you know, you can't grow indefinitely. that is something that if you have a closed system with limited resources, it's just a fact that you can't grow forever.
Well, and also, if we're more efficient per capita, but we increase our per capitas by another 2 or 3 billion people, it's still, the math doesn't work out in that sense.
Yeah, except for that, unlike the bacteria in a petri dish, humans, the better off we are, we seem to reproduce less, which is very interesting, right? That all the rich Western countries are at, you know, replacement level reproduction rates or less than that. And it's the poorest parts of the world where you have large fertility rates. And so that's, you know, an interesting thing to throw into the dynamics to see if raising per capita wealth would decrease fertility rates and decrease, you know, population growth. And so that's kind of another lever on the emissions reduction, you know, your toolkit there.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is Dr. Patrick T. Brown from San Jose State University. We're discussing our future as the climate morphs due to greenhouse gas emissions. Patrick, let's work back to your 2017 paper, Change in the Magnitude and Mechanisms of Global Temperature Variability with Warming. In tune with the theme of your lab at San Jose, you raised the difficulty of trying to model a system that is in flux, and earlier science assessed the natural variability of the weather and then tried to model changes we would expect based on greenhouse gas emissions. But you ask, what if that natural variability also changes with the climate? Could you explain that problem and what you found?
Yeah, so, I mean, the vast majority of the variability that we experience is just internally generated from the Earth system, from the ocean atmosphere system. And so, you know, we know that, like, just from day-to-day experience, that it could be very hot one week and then very cold the next week. And a lot of that has to do with just the Earth kind of moving warm and cold air masses around the surface. So when you experience it to be very cold in first, you know, a week, that means it's warm somewhere else because a cold air mass moved over you. And so then a warm air mass must have moved over them. And so this is the type of variability that we're studying, but we're studying how that variability changes when you change the large boundary conditions, in this case, the amount of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. So in those experiments, those were mostly modeling experiments. We were looking at pre-industrial conditions, so before the Industrial Revolution, and how variability, just like temperature variability, acted under those conditions. And then under using climate models, physical climate models, under a scenario where you double CO2 and you're no longer warming, you've just allowed the whole system to warm up to wherever it wants to be with a doubling of CO2, then looking at the variability in that scenario and comparing the two. And so what we found, this is counter to the narrative that you'll often see in the news these days. We found a large reduction in global temperature variability when the Earth is warmer. And the reason for that was that when the Earth is warmer, you melt a lot of the sea ice. And so when there's not sea ice in the system anymore, that means that you can't have this positive sea ice albedo feedback that contributes to variability. So I'll just say, like, in the pre-industrial state, you have sea ice there. And so when you have a natural bit of warming, you can melt some of that sea ice. And so then that causes less radiation to be reflected back to space and causes more warming. And so you have this positive feedback. We hear a lot about this positive feedback in terms of global warming, but this is also active under just natural variability. And so that causes there to be larger variability, where in the warmer system where you don't have sea ice at all, that feedback is not active. And so then you don't have as large of variability. However, a big caveat to that was that we did find that in lower latitude land regions, like over the Amazon rainforest, for example, that's where we actually found increased variability. And that's largely because as it gets warmer, it gets drier in those locations. And so then when you have some incoming energy, it's no longer used to evaporate water at the surface. It's used to warm up the surface. And so then you can actually get increased variability over land in low latitudes while you have a decrease in variability globally. So that's easier to show, like, with a map than it is in words. But that was, in essence, what we found in that study.
Well, if I'm hearing you correctly, it's possible that the weather might be hotter but somewhat more stable in a warmer world. Is that possible?
Yes. That's what we were showing, is more consistent temperature from decade to decade over most of the world under a warmer climate. And so, yeah, like, that is counter to what is said a lot of times, where people say that as it gets warmer, it's also going to become more variable and more unpredictable. And our results don't show that. And so that's still something that's very hotly debated in climate science, for sure, is where and when and if variability will change. I mean, it's quite clear that the mean changes and gets warmer. I personally, scientifically, am skeptical of claims that variability will increase. I don't see it in the data. I don't see it in the observational data, and I don't see it in the modeling data either. So I would say that the main threat from climate change is not increased variability. It's just the raw increase in temperature and then increased time spent at extremely hot temperatures that are non-linearly damaging to things like crop yields and to human mortality and labor productivity.
I'll have to rethink a few things, because that seems different from, for example, what James Hansen pointed out when he was talking about a sigma 5 shift in extremes. We don't know what sigma 5 means, but we can sure see on a chart that he was showing that normal is shifting towards extremes, which then become the new normal. So it's hard for us to absorb the idea that, well, it may not be more stormy or wild, it just may be hot.
Yeah, so he has a graph where he shows like a bell curve shifts to the right and then it gets wider as it shifts, right?
Exactly.
So he actually did make a mistake there. So this is pretty much accepted that it was an incorrect calculation, that he started mixing different regions in that bell curve. And so what he's really showing is that different regions are warming at different rates, not that the variability at any given location is spreading out. So there was an actual mathematical mistake with that result. That's why all this stuff is still controversial. But, and also, the other thing is with extremes, like, if the bell curve is shifting to the right, that naturally increases your warm extremes, right? And so we have to keep that as, like, a separate conceptual result, because that's, like, kind of a straightforward, obvious thing, that if you shift the bell curve to the right, the warm extremes increase. So, yeah, the warm extremes will increase. The question is, do the cold extremes also increase? And the data shows no, really. I mean, the cold extremes are decreasing just as much as the warm extremes are increasing. And so that, you know, there's maybe some locations in some seasons where you can tease out and find that, oh, the cold extremes aren't decreasing as much as we would expect. And so maybe the bell curve is flattening a little bit, and then people come up with theories as to why that is, you know, having to do with the jet stream and things like that. But I'm telling you, from what I've seen, that is not a robust, strong signal in the data.
Wow. Well, you know, when I try to guess at the future during a climate shift, I recall the troubles my parents' generation went through. They suffered the Great Depression, then World War II, at least 100 million lives lost, cities bombed flat, genocide. And they got through it, some say stronger, but that's the kind of times I fear my grandson will have to navigate rather than what you and I have lived through. Given from what you know from climate science, how do you see the future, Patrick?
I am very hesitant to say anything definitive about the future. I just imagine people in 1920 speculating about what society and what the world will look like in 2020. And there's just no way that they could have, you know, guessed what would have come about. You know, this is before nuclear energy, before World War II, before, you know, way before the computers and the internet and cell phones and smartphones. And I would expect that the difference between 1920 and 2020 will be much, much smaller than the difference between 2020 and 2120. And so I really don't think that I have any authority whatsoever to say anything about the future other than what I can say about kind of physical climate science, which is very much in a vacuum compared to all of society and all of the future. So I don't know what the future will look like, and I don't know how worried to be about climate change versus other things that you could come up with to be worried about. There's plenty of things that you could come up with to be worried about. And I wouldn't know exactly how to prioritize them, honestly.
I think I do. And I think that climate change is the major threat we face. I mean, there is nuclear annihilation, an asteroid arriving, all sorts of things could happen in society. But it seems like now climate change is a given from what we've already put up in the atmosphere. And I think we're going to have to prepare, adapt, and do what we can to get through it.
I agree with that. I think that there's much more uncertainty around the impacts than is often discussed, at least in the media, you know, and that is very much tied to human systems and how human systems react and respond. And so that's the thing to me that I end up just throwing my hands up and saying, you know, it's very difficult to make any type of quantitative projection as to how we expect the quote unquote world to be like if we're incorporating human society into that.
I see in your CV you have four more papers in preparation. What should we be looking for in your upcoming work?
So we've been working on a number of things. Honestly, the thing I'm most excited about is not even on my CV right now. I'm interested in wind and solar droughts, essentially. So if we do follow the market forces of wind and solar energy becoming much cheaper, as well as the legal mandates that we're imposing to have more wind and solar energy, then we expect that our future electricity generation system will be mostly based on wind and solar. And so that means that it will be more sensitive to weather variability than the current energy system. And so in particular, if you have a week or something over a large location like the United States, where you have reduction in wind and reduction in solar energy reaching the surface because it's cloudier, then you would have potentially, you know, a big problem in terms of energy production. And so since I'm in a department of climate science and meteorology, this is kind of a natural thing to study, is to study the meteorology associated with these wind and solar droughts. And then also if they were to co-occur with, you know, very hot temperatures, so that would be kind of a demand, energy demand flood, then that would be extra bad in terms of how the energy system, you know, it's stressed on the energy system. And so we're interested in studying that so that we can inform how to best create a future electricity generation system based primarily on wind and solar that's going to be the most robust to these natural oscillations in wind and solar energy resources. And I think that's something that's going to be more and more on the minds of energy system planners as wind and solar penetrates further and further and we start reducing coal and natural gas as producers of electricity.
You've caught my attention with that one. I'll be looking forward to it coming out from San Jose State University in California. We have been speaking with Dr. Patrick Brown. He's assistant professor in the Department of Meteorology and Climate Science. And we covered a lot of science here, and I will put links to the original papers in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Patrick, thank you for talking with us again on Radio EcoShock.
Yeah, it was great to be here. Thanks a lot.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.